I think the thing that Denny was saying about like being on borrowed time, I do think that that's something that comes up in everyone's life.
Yeah.
So I wonder if Denny's saying that as a joke, but if he really means it, does he feel like he's on borrowed time?
Yeah, because there's that evolution of like, I hope I don't get cut, I hope I don't get cut. And then it's like, oh, I'm any day now.
Any day you get cut. And then as soon as like auditions come around, it's like, all right, well, this is the last show. This is my last show. How many fake last shows do you think you've done?
At least five.
Yeah. I mean, how about you, Dressable? You ever feel like you did a last show? Well, you did get cut.
Yeah.
Well, how did, what was the last show like before you got cut? Do you remember it?
I don't remember it at all.
It was a Robber Baron show?
No, I got cut from Dybbuk.
Dybbuk. Oh, right.
Yeah. You were on Dybbuk?
Yeah.
Man, you know, right now, it really sounds like we're having a long-form conversation podcast.
Sure does.
Recorded at UCB Comedy Studios in New York City. This is the Long Form Conversations Podcast with your hosts, Sean Diston and Nicole Dressbell. Hello, America and other countries around the world. This is the UCB Long Form Conversation Podcast. My name is Sean Diston, and I'm with the lovely, incredibly smart, talented, known around the world, Nicole Dressbell. How are you, Nicole?
I'm great, Sean. Thank you for that introduction.
I'm doing great. I do want to let you know that I went to this audition today. We talked about it earlier where in the breakdown it said there's like, we have like a Nicole Dressbell type. And you said you're not going in for it.
Because nobody called me.
But they're using your type in order
are
to cast this commercial. Yeah. But I want to let you know that this commercial is probably a disaster.
Yeah. Is it a big, real commercial?
And we can't talk about it. I signed a non-disclosure.
And it said Nicole Dressbell type.
Wait, hold on. Uh-huh.
You made signed, it.
No, it didn't say Nicole Dressbell type. What it said was, we are considering asking these people, and it listed me among them. Oh, I have not been contacted.
Do you think I'm violating the non-disclosure at this point?
No, I don't think you're violating it, okay. But I just think like you signed an NDA, and the first thing you did was voluntarily bring it up on a podcast.
You better believe it, baby. Our guest today, you've already heard her silky smooth voice. One of the greats here at the UCB Theater, veteran improviser, veteran sketch performer, Catherine Mudon. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Sean. Hi, Nicole. Culture of applause.
Ben will put in some applause later.
Can you amp up the applause, Ben?
Can we sweeten
for that moment?
Hello, Catherine. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, guys. This is a real treat.
We want to just get right down into it because we've got so much to talk to you about, and We like to start off the podcast the same way every time. Nicole, would you like to take us through the way we start these interviews?
Yeah, we start every interview with the who, the what, and the where. So, Catherine, before you took your first improv class, who were you? Where were you?
And what were you doing?
Oh, my God. I love it. I was a recent graduate from acting school, working at J. Crew, broke as a joke.
Which acting school? Can you talk about that for
a second? American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
And that is in?
33rd and Madison.
33rd and Madison.
Great. And then I went to ASCAT, and that was my first introduction to improv.
Interesting. So how did you end up going? So wait, before we talk about even ASCAT, you're a recent grad from the American Academy of
Dramatic Arts.
ADA. So had you already, like, you grew up thinking you wanted to be an actress? Is that something that was like a big part?
In high school, I was like, Mom, I have to do this. And she's like, go to college and study something real.
What did you study?
I got a BS in neuropsychology.
Holy shit.
It's really not. I've talked to
How
Ben Warhite
about
this. How do you
not talk about that all the time? I've known
I think
you.
It's one of those majors that sounds more crazy than it really is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not that smart
and I did just fine.
I've heard that too
that
about.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. The coolest stuff we did was like surgery on like rats.
Oh my gosh.
Like, it was really fun. And it was a tiny school, so we'd have like 7 people in our class. Mm-hmm. And we had the Rat Olympics every year where you like train your rat and do these mazes. And
but
it was really fun.
This whole time you're doing it, you're thinking, all right, I'm just doing this so that I can have a foundation to maybe try my hand at acting later.
Yeah.
Or was there ever a time where you considered another profession?
I was just really dumb about college in general. Like, I never visited campus before I enrolled.
Which college?
It was just a Jesuit school in Denver. So we just, like, drove over the mountains and dropped me off.
I'm going here. This is my major.
This is my life now. And then I learned they didn't have a music department. They didn't have a theater department.
They didn't have them?
No. So there were, like, small groups for, like, extracurricular ones. So I would do, like, whatever. I don't even remember.
So your plan was, I'll go to the school for this, and I'll join the theater program. They showed up. There's no theater program.
Yeah. So then junior year, I was like, Mom, I want to transfer to Boulder. And she went to Boulder, and she was like, the hell you will.
Because she didn't like it.
It's just a big party school.
She went to Boulder. You never went to Boulder, even though you asked to transfer there?
Yeah.
I think because
she and my dad both went to Boulder.
It's a crazy party school, right?
Yeah, and they were like, they're in the 60s and blah, blah, blah. So they're like, no, we're not paying for you to go to Boulder.
But Catherine, that's so funny that they went and scoped it out on your behalf.
Not even scoped it out.
They went there.
25 years later.
They went there.
They were
graduates. I thought the story was that they were like, all right, Catherine, well, we'll go look.
Nope.
They graduated from CU. That would be the beginning of a much different interview where it's like, Catherine was like, I escaped my parents when I was 19. That's interesting. So you graduated from that.
My senior year, my aunt sent me a clipping from the Denver Post that Ada was having auditions downtown at a hotel.
Oh, wow.
So I, like, took a selfie before there were selfies. I'm dating myself. Took a selfie against a wall, attached it to my application, memorized a monologue, and then went and auditioned.
What monologue?
And do it right now.
Oh, my God. What did I even do? I don't even know.
It was only one monologue?
Do you know what I maybe... It's possible I did the deleted scene from Waiting for Guffman where Parker Posey does her piece. Have you guys seen that scene? Ben?
No.
Anybody?
No.
Oh, my God. Treat yourselves. Buy the Guffman DVD. Uh-huh. Watch the deleted scenes. And there's an extemporaneous monologue that Parker Posey just did off the cuff where she's auditioning. And it's just basically about, like, incest. And
interesting.
Yeah. It's really,
so
really funny.
So the monologue
funny.
You chose was improvised?
I think I did
improvised?
The Waiting for Guffman.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Very interesting.
So you knew comedic actress, though.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Like, Guffman I would watch, like, religiously. Like, I think I had a good taste in comedy, but I didn't know
that. Yeah, talk about that. What were some of the things that you... Was it, like, movie comedies, or were you into, like, sitcoms, or did you like cartoons? I mean, what was your comedy?
Well, in high school... Okay, so I'm going way back, and stop me if I'm being, like, too indulgent.
Please, this is what this
Catherine,
is about.
Catherine, you're a guest on the podcast. Earlier, I think people should know that earlier she said that sometimes she, like, doesn't talk on group podcasts.
This might be the one episode where the guest apologizes for talking every few minutes because it just doesn't seem right.
I think I have trouble listening to podcasts, so actually being on one is, like, extremely challenging. Okay, so long story long. Yeah. I went to Holy Family School from K through 8. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was in a neighboring town, Grand Junction. So then we didn't have a Catholic high school, so I went to public high school in Fruita. So when I started ninth grade, I had no friends because all of my K through 8 friends went to Junction High and I had to go to Fruita High. Same with you?
Yeah. Catholic grade school, public high school. I had no friends.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So ninth grade, no friends. And then by 10th grade, I, like, kicked it in and I was like, oh, if I'm funny, I can get friends. Mm. So I think around 10th grade.
Started to, like, feel like you were a funny person.
Yeah.
People thought you were the funny person in the group of friends.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Fair to say.
And what comedy did you like? Like, what did you want to do when you pictured yourself acting?
I mean, I'm dating myself again, but these were, like, the Seinfeld years.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Like, we're talking 97, 98, 99. So I guess it was off by then.
So, like, the must-see TV, Friends, Seinfeld.
I wasn't into Friends, but I loved Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, foreshadowing, we'll maybe talk about that a little bit later.
Maybe. What were you going to say?
Not important. What was the question you were going to ask?
So you end up in New York. You take classes at the American...
Yeah. So I auditioned for this school.
AMDA.
There's an AMDA. AMDA is the American Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts. So that's the musical theater one.
Got it.
Did not have musical theater.
Okay.
Anyway, so yes, I auditioned for that. I got in. I was so excited. So I had to save, like, $16,000? Anyway,
was
so
that
I
a
deferred.
Bit of, was that a bit of a kind of contentious thing with your parents? Like,
no, if I finished undergrad, they didn't care.
Right. It was similar for
me.
They
were proud of me.
Yeah,
same.
They were like, do this. And I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Like, if I had moved to New York at 18 or made any choice at 18, it would have been, a nightmare.
I went to college. I didn't know I wanted to do comedy or anything, but I have a degree in building construction.
That's right. I forget about
that. It's so useful.
It's I mean,
what if you need it one day?
I don't remember anything from it now.
Okay.
But when I moved to New York, I got my first job in that field and allowed me to take classes. So I always am like, oh, man, I wish I didn't go to college and just come to UCB. But I'm like, maybe I wouldn't have made it.
I remember that because in our first class together, you're like, at work, I have access to these huge printers.
Yeah.
And you could print all those show posters that were like 10 feet wide.
Quick story about that is there was a large format printer in a small room, maybe the size of this podcast room. And I would have to print out like hundreds of these large documents. So I'd go in there for a long period of time where I would get a suggestion from someone on GChat. And then I would go in there and do a one-person herald by myself while working with this machine. Those were my maybe darkest days in doing improv in the indie community. But yeah, like having that degree allows you to have the freedom with your parents to just go off and kind of follow your dream.
Yeah, yeah.
So you went to ASCAT. What made you go to ASCAT that one time?
Wait, I don't want to skip in a very important chapter.
Oh, my goodness.
So to save money to move to New York, I had to move back home. My first job was working in a snow cone shack that my sister was the boss of.
Oh, my God.
So my little sister was my boss. So that was
that
the first
sounds like a sitcom on, like, must-see TV.
But then a couple of months later, I got my sweet dream job at the United States Postal Service. So that was honestly, like, one of the best-paying jobs in town. I was a mail processing clerk. So I would work like six 12-hour days. So by mid-Wednesday, I would hit overtime.
Oh.
Yeah. And so then, I mean, I was, in my mind, I was making decent money. Now I realize that, whatever.
Well, I mean.
For the town, it was really good
and
money.
And not paying rent, living at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just worked for a year and like saved up enough money for 2 years of acting school.
Wow.
Awesome.
Yeah. That was great.
So you, that's so interesting.
And I was so strong.
Yeah. Because it's so funny because a lot of times it's like, go, take the leap, just go out there. But you just basically were like, I'll take the year to work, save up the money. And do you think that helped you when you came here? You were just like very set up and it was very stable?
I don't function well under like dire straits. I'm not a personality that is like, you know, push yourself and be broke and then you'll just learn to swim.
Yeah.
I need to have like, know that I have like a bed and food and then I can feel like creative.
Mm.
Some people can do it. Some people have to like
have a fire under their ass.
Yes, 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 exactly.
Very interesting. So what did bring you to ASCAP?
My roommate at the time had a friend who had done Teach for America in New York, and she was visiting again, and she's like, oh, there's this fun thing that this fun place we used to go to. We'll meet you after work. We have to, like, sit on a sidewalk for, like, 3 hours, but we'll get Chipotle first. And so just come and meet us after work. So I leave my shift. And I'm like, the last thing I want to do, it was in May. It was Fleet Week. I remember it distinctly.
Oh,
the last thing I want to do on Fleet Week is to go sit on a sidewalk in Chelsea.
In the sun.
Eating a hot burrito. Anyway, so I went and met my friends and we did exactly that. And then we went in and it was just like, I think John Krasinski was there. Will Arnett was like behind. We were in that back row. So like Will Arnett was like standing in the aisle behind us.
What year was this, Catherine?
This was Fleet Week 2007.
Oh, wow.
And I remember it was Fleet Week because the friend of the friend was like hot. Mm-hmm. I just air quoted that for people.
Wow.
I don't know why she is hot.
Cool.
So a bunch of sailors were like, you want seats? Because we would have had to have sat on the stage
right,
or whatever.
Right, right.
And they're like, you want seats? It's a hot girl. Have our seats. Have our seats. So these sailors gave us their seats.
Wow.
And so we sat and I watched my very first improv
and
show.
Was it immediately blown away?
Yeah. It was like magical. It was really, really great. Mm. And so I went all summer. And then after ASCAT, I discovered Stepfathers, and I just went all summer to both of those.
And how long before I'm signing up for a class? Like, how long did it take
May,
you?
June, July, August, 4 months.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder how many people's first show is ASCAT and how much that just, like, was it yours, ASCAT?
Yeah.
I just started teaching 101, and it's mostly what they'll go to, it seems.
Yeah.
It's just fun. It's a real pleaser.
Yeah. My first show was, like, a weeknight kind of show, and I remember it being like good and I enjoyed it. It was like the soap opera, improvised soap opera.
Oh my gosh,
show.
As the Diamond Burns.
That was my first show.
Wow.
And I saw it paired with like a sketch show, and I saw like a couple sketch shows, but the first big improv show I saw was ASCAT. And yeah, I think that was the one where I was like, ooh, there's something here that was magic.
For sure.
And it was, yeah.
It had a couple years where it was, like, real, real sweet.
Yeah. Well, when I went, it was, the first one I went to was, like, Mantzoukas, and I think maybe Amy was there.
Yeah.
And Chris Gethard only, he just did monologues.
Yes, yep. And Tamanik, too. He would do monologues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those were crazy days.
And we didn't even know who Gethard was, and we thought he was such a good storyteller that because he would do it pretty regularly, and we'd be like, oh, good, good, good. There's a good monologist. So, we were so picky by the end. We were so discerning. Like,
so you were going with these same friends most weeks.
Yeah.
And did they ever find their way into...
Years later, one of them took two levels. They took a 101 and a 201 just to, like, gain life skills or, like, see the universe differently, but it didn't stick.
So
you just also you're broke and it's free.
Yeah. ASCAT is free.
So you go splurge on a Chipotle burrito, which you can make two meals out of, and then sit on the sidewalk and then get a free show. I mean, it's a great wind down to the week.
Yeah, definitely. And if you have the, like, energy to go do it, it's perfect thing to do.
You're 23, 24, who cares?
So August 2007, you take 101. Mm-hmm. Who did you take your 101 class with?
I went to the website.
Bobby Moynihan?
Yes.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, he's the only one I recognize from ASCAT.
Right.
And it was like, I still remember it said one slot's left.
Ooh.
And I was like, I'm just doing it.
Yeah. So what was that like? What was your impression of the first class?
Because I think maybe the best 8 weeks of my life.
Wow.
The most met. He was, first of all, a brilliant improviser. Second of all, a gifted teacher.
I think he was pretty known for, like, jumping into scenes, too, right?
Yeah, he jumped into two scenes over the 8 weeks, and both of them were mine. I remember those 8 weeks as if it was, like, yesterday. Like, every week, like, made such an impression on me. I still remember, like, notes he gave people and, like, who was in the... It was, like, every week was, like, a flashbulb memory.
Yeah. Do you think going in with, like, the acting background made it more enjoyable for you? Because I feel like sometimes in 101, people are just getting over that fear.
Mm-hmm.
I was never afraid, but I was burned from acting school of learning, like, oh, I don't fit in with the theater crowd. I don't mix with the theater kids. I'm not good at, like, drama, classical drama. So I was feeling just kind of jazzed to be like, oh, I'm better at this. I'm funnier than I am dramatic.
Right.
So that felt good. That was a really fun. And I still remember, this is, because I have to say this or else I'll forget. I remember Bobby describing, I think, game or just improv. And he said, it's two people looking at each other. Have I already told you this?
Mm-mm.
I don't think it's in our whatever
curriculum,
lingo. Yeah. So it's two people looking at each other, describing to one another what's on the wall behind them.
Ooh.
And it probably took me like 3 or 4 years to be like, oh.
That's so interesting.
Like trying to find the game together.
Right.
It's like, I'm describing what's on the wall behind you, and you're telling what's on the wall behind you. And that's what a scene is.
That's awesome.
It's really, like, lovely, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
probably bit early for 101.
That's so funny because I think back to my 101 and I kind of had Kevin Hines and I kind of remember Kevin giving notes like that, but I just can't remember one. I that time was such a blur for me.
Yeah.
Did were you still doing the acting program there or had you already
given graduated.
Up?
I graduated in April and then May went to the show. So that summer I was free.
So when you started taking 101, were you like all in immediately or did you kind of keep a foot in the acting world and keep, because I feel like you are a very well-rounded person. You still have like a full life outside of UCB.
I didn't have a full life. I was working a lot just to make rent. So because of that, I paced myself with classes because it would take a long time to earn $300 that you could just throw away.
Yeah.
And so that's very
students,
choosy.
Classes were $300 a few
years ago. I
think
that's right. Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, that's totally right. Now they're almost $500.
Are they really?
They're
it's
so
$450,
expensive.
I think, for some classes.
At least $400 for 101, $425,
yeah.
$400.
Well, so you spaced them out.
But still, it was a lot of money, regardless. A lot of money. So I was very choosy about, after that, I was very choosy about like who I would study with. So I only studied with like,
people
in my mind, the
from
finest.
The stepfathers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I went pretty slow with classes.
I don't think you went that slow. Because we took something I learned last night. So we're just going to air this on the podcast.
Yeah.
You and I are improv twins. Like, we took every level within like a month of each other.
That
and
is
yet
so cool.
Did not know each other at all.
No.
Is it cool? I think it's sad. I'm so sad for us because we didn't meet for like 4 years.
We wouldn't have been ready. Like, what if something had happened?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That actually
like
occurred to me. Part of me was like, what if we had broken it?
Yeah.
Like, what if we dodged something?
Who did you have for 201?
I had Neil.
And what month was that?
It was October 2007.
And when did I take it?
October 2007. You started October 15th, 2007 with Joe Wengert.
So 2 months later, I already took 201?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And then you started, maybe the bigger gap was 301. You started 301 February 2008.
Oh, okay.
And I started January 2008.
See, but that to me, that almost feels a little
slow-played
because when I took classes, I literally was like, this class ends next week. We exactly. have this. Right. And it was easier to get in to classes.
Oh, but back also then, classes absolutely. Shut down. So in October 2001 was the last class of 2007.
Right. So you'd have to wait.
Okay. Had to wait.
Oh.
Yeah. This is
disgusting. 301 was Zach.
Know this. 301 was with Zach?
Zach right. Woods.
And then who was your four?
401 was... No, I'm sorry. 301 was Gavin. 401 was Neil.
And then Zach for four.
And then you had to pass 401.
Yeah.
And I was so self... By 401, I had ruined myself. Mm-hmm. And I was so filled with self-hatred. I was like, I'm not even asking.
I just retook it.
I think without
I remember
even
hearing you say that. And I was like, Mudon, that's such a Catherine thing.
I didn't even want to find out if I passed. I was so certain that I hadn't passed that I took, after Neil, I took Zach.
So let's talk about that for a sec. So you finish 101, great 8 weeks, amazing 8 weeks for you.
Yeah.
You get into 201, 301. What starts to be the turning point as far as like, now I'm in my head?
201, I didn't like my classmates, so that sucked. I was right. like, oh. I don't think I have any friends from 201. I still have, like, Jonathan Fernandez was in 101. Mm-hmm. Starley Klein from NPR, she was in there.
She's great.
Yeah, we had some good people in that 101. 201, I don't remember anybody.
Right.
But then by 301, that was fun. 401 was fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you... I think what happens in those levels is you start to want to be better than you can be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because you recognize great improv, yeah. but you can't do it. Yeah. I think that's the... major frustration in like 201 and 301 is you get good improv
yeah.
And you see so much of it.
It's so true because I remember going to Stepfather's and being like, well, tonight was an off show and let me tell
yeah,
you why.
Yeah, and you told
like
me.
You're so discerning.
Exactly.
And it's
exactly.
like, fuck, you're in 301. What mm-hmm. the hell do you know?
We've also talked about this before, but you were never like a Harold Knight nerd. You were always Stepfather's, right?
Yeah.
You never really went to Harold Knight.
I remember going in. All I remember is DC Pearson was on stage and Sue Galloway was on stage. The crowd was, it was packed, and I was just, like, so claustrophobic. Everyone wow. had beer, and it just was not
You're
the...
You're like, this isn't my speed. I need to go to...
I said, it's Stepfather's, we have wine. Everyone has a chair. What's happening?
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
What was it when Stepfather's was, like, your team? What was yeah. that lineup? Like, what do you remember that lineup being?
I remember when Shannon got on.
Yeah.
So that was early...
It was September 2007.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you know all these dates.
Yeah, well, because this is my timeline also. Yeah. My first Harold Knight yeah. was Shannon and Will's last Harold Knight.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh, so Shannon both... and Will got on to Stepfather's at the same time?
Yes.
Oh wow, I didn't know that.
Somebody
oh.
can fact check this because this is exclusively memory based.
Right,
but
right,
yeah.
Right.
yeah. Yeah, I remember Gausses and Billy mm-hmm. leaving because I remember Bobby talking about it in class. And then I remember Shannon getting on. But in my mind, you would have a solid show as long as Gethard, Zach, and Bobby, as long right. as you had the three of them.
That was
and I think Gethard has said as much, that the three of them had like a great, what was their, they had a side group, five guys
five
or whatever, yeah.
Five dudes.
So as long as you had the three of them, it didn't really matter what else, what other variables were there, but it was just gold. I mean, it was brilliant.
So coming up in those times, like 101, 201, 301, 401 time, do you feel like there were people that you latched onto as far as like performing together in the indie scene?
No.
Did you start to, not at all?
No.
Because I think I did know that about you. Like, I think you went through a lot of the program before you dipped your toe into the indie scene at
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that for a sec. Like, what was
I
that
I remember
like?
Neil Casey in 401 being like, guys, you know, get those reps in. He said, the indie scene was dead. Now it's back. And I was like,
what is that?
What was it? When did it die? Right. What is it back? What does it mean?
I think as a person who's going to exclusively Stepfather's, you could avoid the indie scene altogether if you never had Harold Knight.
Yeah, it's true. That's yeah. really true.
I'm realizing. I'm finding out why we weren't friends.
Because Dressman was exclusively
at
the free
and
show.
And I was like yeah. trying to get some
Mudon
thank
was
you
paying
robot
the
strange.
$8 to go see Stepfather's.
Yeah. yeah. Oh, that's another thing. The kids, the shows, the weekend shows.
Oh my God, they were
$8. Yeah. Yeah.
That's true. So you heard, but you heard that from Neil and you were like, whatever.
Yeah. Who has time? I didn't have time for that.
Because right. of work?
Yeah.
Wow. Because you have like a career. You have even still now, you have like a real job that you're interested in outside of comedy stuff, right? Maybe.
I have a career that is afforded me the lucky opportunity to
do comedy,
to live comfortably. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
What is that career? Can you talk about it?
Yeah, that's
very mysterious.
You're right. The longer we don't follow up, the more
Because I was like, I just realized that I was on a team with Catherine, and I don't know what her day job.
Oh, really?
I assume she didn't have one.
I said it like I'm an assassin.
I wonder if I could guess. I think I know what it is.
The way I described it is, though, like, I kill people for money.
Yeah.
Like, I have a career. It's afforded me the luxurious lifestyle.
I have another life. No, I work, currently I work in a photography studio where I style merchandise for online shopping.
Oh, I did know that.
It's called e-commerce photography. So I tell people, when you're online shopping and there's like seven angles of a shoe,
and they're all wrong and they're not what the shoe actually looks like when you buy it.
Not if Catherine did it.
Well, no, yes, because my job is to make the stuff look much better than it will look when you buy it, when it comes to you in your mailbox.
That's like when people take pictures of food. It's like, you can't eat the food they're taking pictures
of. No, because the lettuce is covered in Vaseline. Yeah.
So anyway, you were busy with that job, couldn't do any sort of indie scene thing. When did you, you dipped your toe into that. I think we're getting up to the first, it was Dreadnought the first indie team?
Well, by, so 401, I was frustrated and didn't think I was good. 501, I was ready to quit. So I took my first 501 with Anthony King. Mm. Conversely, was like the worst 8 weeks of my life.
And that must have been tough because he was AD at the time, right?
He was, and I don't think I even realized.
But I think everyone else did.
Yeah.
And they were freaking out about it.
Yeah. And I remember auditions had happened to be then, and I remember, what's her name? Jessica Stickles got on, Paul Walsh didn't. And I was like, something's off.
Yeah,
this isn't
right.
That's got to be 2009 then.
I don't know when it was.
That's got to be May 2009 because that's Bishop, if Jessica Stickles got on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was still way out. I was just watching from the outside.
But that's already a year and a half into you doing improv.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're still not super involved.
No, I was ready to quit.
I think that's pretty unique because I think the involvement is kind of what keeps people around sometimes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Maybe it would have.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it was just miserable. It was horrible. I would like cry like every night after class on the train home. Yeah. And it was just like, what am I paying to do this for? This is horrible.
So
anyway, so during that Anthony King class, Benjamin Apple was on his phone. He was like, oh my God, Gethard's teaching again. Gethard's coming out of retirement, or whatever the turn of phrase was. Right. And Gethard was teaching at 501, a 4 week, I think, whatever. So on my iPhone during the break, I registered for it online because I was such a Gethard head from...
Yeah. Stepfather isn't.
Had to check him off my list. Get that Gethard class, and that like in my mind, like officially changed like the course of my improv.
So
career.
Real quick question before we dive into that: was that before Raphael? Because that was an indie team too.
Like, yes, before. I've done nothing at this point. Nobody knows who I am.
So let's talk about these classes for a sec, because these were this was a huge time at UCB. I think
it was a sea change for a lot of people.
I think so. Gethard comes back. Had not been teaching for a while, starts offering these 4 week classes where I think the focus of it was like, I couldn't even describe what the focus was. Do you remember what it was, Glenn?
How would I articulate the focus? Doing stuff that is meaningful and is worth your time and worth the audience's time and is pushing the boundaries of basically building something so collective and so collaborative and building this fire together and then pushing the boundaries and figuring it out together.
Yeah. I took the class too, and it definitely felt like we're taking the philosophies we've learned for improv and we're moving them to an almost non-improv level.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't about like supporting the scene. I was like supporting the other improvisers.
We don't say game. Like there was nothing about game moves.
It was a pretty abstract class, but I think he taught four of them. And in all four of them, there were just stories about things happening in the class where it was like, wow, we're really pushing them. Like, I think the first one, they left the classroom and went out into the street and did like a whole set on 30th Street, right? You weren't in that one. You might have been in the second one.
I was in the first one, but I don't think we did that, did we?
Okay. I know one of the classes left the room, and that was where everyone was like, I got to sign up for this Gethard class.
Yeah.
But you were in the first one with, tell us who was in the class.
So that was Noah Foreman, Don Finelli, Michael Caine, Jesse Lee. So the five of us formed an indie team called Dreadnought. And then who else was in that class?
Dom?
It was stacked.
Did you say Dom?
Don.
No, Dom Manzalillo.
Don Manzalillo. Oopsie. Yes. Sorry,
also
Dom.
In the class. Great.
And also on Dreadnought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Wait, there's five people on Dreadnought. No, there's six.
Okay, this is, I wanted to run interference just because, like, Dom's going to hear this and this is his nightmare.
No, Dom knows I love him.
Oh, boy. Here
Dom
we
knows
go.
I love him. I thought I said Dom. I'm sorry.
No, Dom and Don's on this.
That's true. That's their fault.
Kolsky was in that class.
Right.
Nate Russell was in that
class. Was Alana Glazer in that class?
Wow, yeah. That's a stacked class.
They were all very stacked. Weirdly, did Gethard pick the classes or?
I don't think so. Because I just registered online.
Interesting question. Mm-hmm. Are they stacked in retrospect because it was so formative to people who became really great improvisers, or were they just stacked by coincidence?
I think they were stacked because even people on teams were like, I'm going to go take a class with Gethard. I took my class with like Corey Brown, Dan Klein.
Wow.
Paul Downs.
Oh, wow.
I mean, our class was super stacked, too. And I remember all the classes kind of were like that.
And that was the second one?
We were the last one, I think.
Okay.
But, yeah, that class was, like, really formative. So that class was where you first met people where you were like, okay, now I'm willing to step out into this indie community.
Yeah. Well, that was the first teacher who, like, even, like, saw anything in me or advocated for me at all. Mm-hmm. And so that just like felt really good. And then if the teacher's advocating for you, I feel like other classmates are like, oh yeah, she is.
I do think that's true. And even adversely, like sometimes I feel like if you're a teacher or a coach and you're noting one person pretty hard, you got to watch out sometimes for like the other team turning on them.
Yeah.
Because they'll be like, yeah, that is why this sucked, you know?
Like our scene didn't work because they did do that.
Yeah. And I think Gethard is one of those people, even when he's giving a bad note, he's not going to let that happen. Yeah. He gives the bad note in a way that it's like on everyone.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's an interesting thing in that class is like, there was almost none of that.
Yeah.
As opposed to some of the other classes, I really felt this connection with the people in the class where it was like, wow, we've been pushed and we've been on this journey together.
Yeah, it
was interesting, yeah.
Absolutely. I remember, because it was like so constructive in the criticism of like, Mudon, you got to get off that back line. You're on that back line because you don't realize how fucking good you are, like how hard you can throw down. So you hear that and you're just like,
you're encouraged. Even if you don't believe it.
Yeah. I also think that's a note that so many people give wrong. Like when you're on the back line and you feel stuck on the back line, I think a lot of people note to shame. Like you got to get out there. But Gethard gives the note as a way of like, I don't. That just feels like you got to just get up. You deserve it. We want more.
He puts the power in your hands.
And it's not shame. It's not condescending. It's
empowering.
It's not that you're doing it wrong. It's just that like here's this other thing you can be and should be doing.
Yeah,
he's smart.
He's such a gifted team, and he's done one-offs with teams over the years. And he can come in, do a one-off with in theory, seven strangers and you, and look at the eight of you and be like, this is your deal. This is what you do. And he will assess. You'll just watch him assess teammates with like the most precision. And they are strangers to him.
Yeah. It's pretty remarkable. And I just think it comes with the years and years he did.
Oh, he's such
beforehand.
A like wizard.
Do you think that was your main note coming up?
Oh,
like getting off the back line?
Yep. Get off the back line.
Looking back on that now, what do you think the reason was that was a huge note for you?
Well, looking back on it now, it was a very, I hate this word aggressive, but there were a bunch of aggressive players. So I was working just by default, working on the muscle of listening and supporting and like going with, going with Michael's idea, going with Noah's idea,
right.
Going with Don's idea, going with Dom's idea.
good.
Loving Dom's ideas. But so when you're in a group of that, and I don't have a problem with it. I know now that I am a stronger player if I'm supporting what everybody else is building.
Right.
So I don't have, it's like yin and yang to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because any team or show that you have all of one flavor, it's disgusting.
Right.
And vice versa. So I don't judge it now, but you do have to have the muscle to be like, here's my thing, here's my move.
Right. That is interesting. I know what you mean. I feel like being surrounded by aggressive players, it's very easy to fall into like the back line. And I wonder how many amazing improvisers kind of get lost in the shuffle there.
Because
I see that a lot in classes. I'll see very great students that have trouble getting into scenes, and it's only because of how supportive and like they want to listen and do it the right
way. It's always like the people who don't need to hear it.
Totally.
Like the people who don't need to like listen and support and slow down are the people who hear it, and the people who do need to hear it, they're not listening, so they're not going to hear it.
Listen, I was the most aggressive 101 through 301 student ever.
Mm-hmm.
I think like in 101, I think Kevin might have even written, someone wrote somewhere like, I'm surprised this guy didn't do improv in college because he's going nuts.
Mm.
And it's just funny that like the opposite note for me was like, they need less from me. And but I bet I was probably more, like I probably heard more or was more confident in my own improv because I would do more and get laughs. And, whereas you're probably doing better improv and it's making you kind of hate yourself in a way. It's just interesting that those two kind of defaults. One can get celebrated, and that, like, for me, telling me to do less, I'm not going anywhere. But I could see people like that hang out in the back line and don't necessarily find their way into shows or scenes being like, you know what, this isn't for me.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas those are the most important people we need sometimes.
They really are. And once you know what you're looking for and watching it, I mean, I don't know sports, but it's like an analogy of like, we celebrate the person who...
Oh, boy.
We celebrate the person who like makes the layup or makes the basket or whatever.
Okay,
but
you're doing Sean's language, but with my words.
Right. But the person who like passed them the ball,
totally.
Nobody is excited about that player.
Totally, totally.
But you can't, in improv, like someone is lobbing you those gifts and mm-hmm. then we celebrate and laugh at the person who like, you know, takes the obvious
totally.
Shot. Whatever.
So, Dreadnought, let's talk about the formation of that team. Legendary cage match performances.
Let's talk about sushi restaurants.
Let's talk about sushi. Let's talk about internet beefs. Let's talk about all of it. Because what's so interesting to me is when I think about Dreadnought as a team and the personality of that team, I do not see Catherine Mudon on that team.
Oh, really?
But you're such a huge part of what made it work. Because without you, it probably would have been too crazy.
That's so nice of you to say. I never thought of it that way. So Dreadnought was a six-person team that was formed in 2009.
Right.
Who took the initiative? Who made Dreadnought happen out of that class?
We finished our Gethard class, and I think within a week or so, Michael Caine emailed us and said, I think his wife was having babies, like he had a real life, and he said, I don't want to stop doing this shit with you guys. Can we put something together? So Michael initiated it and then got Gethard to agree to coach us. So we sort of had this spin-off where Gethard cared enough to coach us, I think often for free.
Yeah.
If not always for free.
I think his MO was if he cared enough, he would do it for free.
Yeah. So I remember we'd meet like at the basement of the Triple Crown before it was built up and like the ceilings were dripping, like any like free to keep it as cheap as possible. We would meet and just do more of what we had done in class, and it was awesome. We didn't have, like, especially good. Like, if you were a stranger and came to one of our shows, like, it was never, like, well, that was great. It was never, like, a stepfather's, like, tipping your top hat of, like, what a great show.
Right, standing ovation. What a great connection.
Yeah, no, not at all. It was just six people really trying to, like, do the, like, Gethard. So this is before the Gethard show. This is before, like, any of... parentheses, et cetera, et cetera. So we were really kind of a germinal little nugget of.
And I think the movement at that time was really just like pushing it.
Yeah.
But in a controlled kind of chaos way. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys did a bunch of indie shows, but I think you did that like, you did the parade. Didn't you do like a parade to an indie show once? I think it was to.
That was for the anniversary of the sushi show. Yeah, we walked around like
Union
Square.
All
right, let's talk about the sushi show.
Yeah.
What does that mean when we say that?
Okay, so on 23rd and 7th across from Dinosaur Barbecue, there used to be a sushi restaurant. And it was run by a restaurateur and what did he call himself? Futurist, named Elvis Newman. So Elvis Newman was a futurist who had seen Gethard perform. And he emailed Gethard at one point saying, come do comedy for my patrons. Like, I think you're great, blah, blah, blah. And Gethard said, no, but I know some wild childs who will be into this. So forwarded us his info. So I was in contact with Elvis Newman, the futurist. He used to have a website that was such a treat.
I remember it.
You got to go to that dude's website. I wonder what he's up to because I don't think the sushi restaurant is there anymore.
Oh, boy.
Dao Sushi, I think it was called. Yeah. So we went into this restaurant. Elvis was so, so excited to have us, loved comedy, and we had a little corner set up for us. No stage, no nothing. And no one actually there to just have dinner knew what was happening or wanted it to be happening. And I remember Gethard was coaching a team and brought them down. Zach Woods was there for some reason.
Because it was heavily advertised, and I do think people showed up. I was like trying to get there, but I couldn't get out of something.
Yeah, like people showed up. And so the restaurant is a huge window facade facing 23rd. So I guess if you were passing by, you could see that there was some like
show
brouhaha happening. And I just recently found the DVD that my friend had taken of it.
I was going to ask you, this was recorded.
Yes,
this was recorded.
My friend was recording it. And you watch it, it's absolute nonsense.
It's chaos.
It's total chaos. There's no mics. And we're just screaming, trying to like build a scene together.
And was there some sort of fight, or did someone...
There was, I think Jesse Lee made a move where he was like out on the sidewalk outside, and then Noah followed him outside, and it was something where the rest of us were inside and then like observing the fight that Noah and Jesse were having out through the glass. And this was a moment in the DVD where actual patrons were laughing because Noah and Jesse are like having this like silent brawl, and then we were like trying to contextualize it from within the restaurant.
So you had kind of hooked him a little bit.
Oh my God. Yeah. And then this is, oh God, I have such a bad memory, but it's all coming back to me. So then this spawned an IRC thread.
Oh my God.
Of like people being like, what horseshit? Why would anybody do that? Blah, 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 blah.
I think what was said was the word coward was said. Something about cowards. And
why were we the cowards?
I don't even remember. But I remember that someone called Dreadnought cowards or something. Or something got said that maybe got misunderstood. And then, of course, Gethard and others jumped on it, basically like mother, like defending you guys. And it became this big controversy, I believe.
I cannot think of a group of people more prone to jump in if they feel like their honor has been impugned.
It was, felt like
I'm thinking about the lineup of that team. And that's like people who are like waiting to defend their honor.
And I think one of the things too is like part of it was people online were kind of calling it out as like, this is not improv, this is just a stunt, whatever.
Fair
assessment.
I mean, I think that was the debate about a lot of the stuff that Gethard was doing. I think if you were inside of it, you knew it was more than that. And if you were outside of that, you were like, oh my God, just sweep at it.
I think that is a huge part of it.
Because you didn't do any tags, no tags, no sweeps. I didn't sweep for 2.5 years.
It was just nonstop amalgam. Like,
yes,
yeah,
it was
yeah.
just like Jell-O, like not even gack. And like just throwing gack against the wall. Like we didn't sweep, we didn't tag.
Did you feel like going into that sort of phase of your improv career, how did that affect you? Because I feel like, and I could be making a huge assumption, but someone who's gone through acting school and you seem to like, you went back and you saved up a bunch of money so you can move to New York. It just seems like you're and you even said you operate better when you have things figured out.
Yeah.
But now you're in this sort of improv thing where you're like raging against that philosophy altogether.
The machine.
Yeah, it's like you're 100% going into the unknown. Was that like a huge awakening for you? Or was it difficult?
No, it was. It was definitely an awakening. That's a good word. Because the other side of playing with dudes like that, or I shouldn't say dudes, people like that, mm-hmm. is you feel so safe and you feel invincible.
Right.
Because you're playing with people that no matter what are mm-hmm. going to, like, you could do a trust fall off, like, the edge of the restaurant. You know what I mean? And, like,
they
fall
would
on the
definitely.
Side. Oh, God, yeah. You can do anything and it's going to be supported. And I feel so lucky and I feel sad for people who maybe, and we've been on teams where, like, whatever, there's judgment and there's reservations and there's caution and mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. And I have those impulses. I'm not saying that I don't. But to be on a team where nobody else like feels that way and then you get to just do anything. Oh, my God. It was so liberating.
The other thing that's crazy about it is a group. Well, maybe with the exception of like, I would say this group that you're playing with, the exception of you, is they're pretty aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
But they're maybe the first super aggressive improvisers that you played with that also listened and
yes.
also supported you.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
that might have been, you know, part of just being in that class with Gethard and that bonding process, right?
Because some people are aggressive in a bullying way and in a controlling way. And this was not that at all.
Mm-hmm.
This was not that at all. It was really, really fun.
I think that's where I ran into some problems in that class is because I was very aggressive. And going into the Gethard class, it was an early ASP just advanced study class. And I remember having trouble with it. And I loved Gethard and I vibed with the class, but I remember not fully being able to just do what Gethard wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it was I was missing a little bit of that. You can be super aggressive and you can be chaotic. But without the fundamental tools of improv, none of it works.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times where I would throw that stuff out or I would go back to the rules way too hard. And that class was difficult for me. But I feel like the Dreadnought crew, that was like their class. And they ran with that philosophy.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I mean, I remember seeing you guys do Cage Match and seeing a team where I was like, oh, this is like a super supportive, insane, good indie team.
Oh God, I remember that. We had like one solid cage match that sticks out in my mind. Maybe the only good cage match show I've ever
was
done.
Was the one where you put a pie on stage and then no one touched it?
What, an actual pie?
Wasn't there a Dreadnought show where you guys walked on stage with a pie, put on a stool, and then did a full set and never did anything with it? I'm pretty sure that that happened.
The one I'm thinking of, we just talked to a guy that was sitting on the, he was sitting on the stage. What was his name? Frank. And so we had Frank involved through the whole show. And I remember Finelli like fell or he was laying around or rolling around. And when he got up, all his body sweat was on the stage.
Floor?
And then I morphed that into a drunk girl who had like spilled her drink. And that was literally, there was literally liquid on the floor. And I was like, babe, my drink is everywhere. And he's like, oh, it's my fucking sweat. Blah, blah. I don't know. This is the show that I remember. But
see, I don't remember that one. I remember one where Jesse, the whole group became some sort of monster and Jesse Lee was being held up.
Oh, that sounds right.
There was some sort of monster. Yeah. But yeah, I remember
and there was
those.
A pie. Interesting.
And I remember those cage matches because they were one of the few times you'd see an indie team and be super
impressed.
Back
in the day, yeah. You can't even, indie teams can't even get in now.
Well, they can because of indie cage match. This again, Catherine, you're no longer at. Catherine has no idea what's happening in the community at any time.
The other day at practice, I said, who the hell is which? Because we got an email about which. And
this
my teammates
was months
are
ago,
like.
Because they're not a team anymore.
They're like, that's a Lloyd team. I said, what on earth is a which?
Oh, that's
see,
so
because
funny.
Now I have to be in bed by 9, and so I don't have time.
I understand. I
don't
understand.
Have time to.
So Dreadnought was great.
But now I've learned to, and I want to follow up with, the things that we were working on, they don't, this is going to be a bold statement, they don't, it's you can't cookie cutter them into a Herald. You don't have 4 minutes to, like, figure out, like, what the thing is. Like, you don't have, like, you need a premise, you need a game move early on. So to marry those two things, I've now realized.
Well, I also think part of why what Gethard does, what Dreadnought does, why it works, is that, like, you have to. If you're doing a Herald, people instinctively become more loyal to the form than to the people they're on stage with.
Right.
And that, like, conflicts with what Gethard is trying to accomplish, what Dreadnought is trying to accomplish, which is, like, your only loyalty and your only rules are the people that you're on stage with. It is aggressive, but it is aggressive support.
I think to a certain extent, just to piggyback off what you're saying, is, like, you can't do a Herald where you're your objective is to do the Gethard show, the Gethard class type deal. But some teams could benefit from the Gethard philosophy.
Having that in your pocket, having that in your tool belt is really, really helpful.
Because you become a team in a way that's like, I've got your back for real.
Yeah.
In a non, like, tap your back before the show type way. Like, I really do. And, if you know, obviously, I think you're right. The Herald is its thing that requires a certain amount of, you know, rules and things that are set in place. But I do think there have been times where Gethard's influence has showed up on Herald Night, and I've always been super impressed with it.
Yeah, and there's so many teams where, like, you'll try to do a, like, someone will initiate an organic group game, and you can just see other people being like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
What are they pulling from? What was in the opening? Right. What premise are they using?
I'll say the thing that I'll explain it. Rather than just jump in and do it, I'll remain slightly off to the side,
yeah,
and I'll make sure that it's organized.
Like, oh, how about the audience can go 30 fucking seconds without laughing while you guys actually build something together and, like, make something that's going to be more interesting than.
That was a big thing in that class, too. Gethard used to say it was, like, the bravest thing you can do is to not be funny for a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, and when I heard that, I remember that being a huge note that I still say sometimes. I'm just like, hey, man, don't worry about being funny right here. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The audience is with you. I was going to say about the influence. I remember when Bastion was doing Heralds and they were, like, crushing these textbook Heralds, really good Heralds every week. And they started working with Gethard. And the Heralds maybe weren't as good. But there was this intangible excitement with their shows, and you could see they were, like, doing new stuff, pushing the boundaries. I just think that was, like, a very interesting time. That Gethard sort of explosion of, like, I mean, Jump on 3 formed out of that, Dreadnought formed out of that, other classes definitely formed.
Well, parentheses, and then the Gethard show, and then now the whole culture of
the whole camp. So Dreadnought happens. You do that for a while. You start playing with Raphael, like, another indie team, right? Let's talk about Macro Scene, because that's what we're all here for, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Drespel just gave a half eye roll for people.
Was this your first? This was your first advanced study performance class.
Yeah.
What were they? Were they
600s?
There were 600. Sorry,
it's my first 600.
That experience going in. How did you feel going into that?
I walked in and I didn't know anybody. I only knew Kolsky. So Kolsky and I got pulled from that Gethard class, same class. I think based only on Gethard's notes.
I think
because Kevin did not know us.
I think Kevin asked Gethard for recommendations, and he recommended you, Kolsky and maybe like, someone else. I don't remember. But yeah, I remember asking Kevin about that.
That was a killer class.
So you didn't
but
know
I
anyone.
Didn't know. I sat by Kolsky and we laughed. We're like, oh, we're strangers. Like, who are these people?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you were there. Curtis Rutherford was there. Dan Black was
don't
there.
Don't try to
Elena.
Do it. Don't try to do okay. it. Because you're going to. I tried to name everyone in the macro scene class and just fell short.
So what year was this? This was the first one.
I think
one.
We could all do it. I think if we did it all together, we could
you,
do it.
You'll forget one. But it is. I think that was 2010.
Terry Withers was in there.
Yep.
Brett White. Katie Healy Wurzburg. Miles Klee.
That Terry Withers just reminded me of a. in my class, where somehow he's in a two-person, not a scene, but a moment with Terry, and he was talking to me through a mirror. So he was looking at a mirror, and I was looking at him, but then I didn't realize there was this mirror. Anyway, this whole scene was like all over the place, and I remember apologizing to Kevin, like, I'm really sorry. I didn't know what we were going for in the scene or, like, what we were trying to build. And Kevin just being like, Catherine, no one knows what Terry is doing. Don't worry about it. Nobody has a clue what Terry was trying to establish.
I was on Robber Baron with Terry while he was in the macro scene. And I just, like, at some point, every scene, we went down a winding staircase.
I mean,
because the macro
was,
scene, you have all those doors and everything Terry did, he had to move so French doors.
Yes.
Terry was
just
the king.
It was always a winding staircase. It was like, we were fine where we were. This room was fine for the
Terry
game.
Terry was the
I don't
king
need to go to your
of
basement.
Finding oh, new ways and new places to go and new doors to open and new... That was such
oh
a fun
my God,
class.
Oh, God, that was a great class. So we lucked out.
We lucked out. I mean, that was...
If I hadn't taken those two classes, I mean, God knows what...
Do you think that that class was kind of instrumental in... When did you start to feel like I'm good enough to be on a team?
By the time Dreadnought all got on teams, I was beyond that and into, like, bitter. So I guess pre-bitter would be...
How many times had you auditioned?
The Dreadnought was my second year. So my first year was like, auditions are happening, I'm just going to do it. The second year was when Dreadnought auditioned and mostly got on. And then...
Oh, right.
By third year, fourth year, and fifth year, I was just into full angry bitterness.
Right, because that was the like...
Oh, yeah, that was Opera Monstro. And Monstro. So that was yes. Don, that was Kane, that was Jesse. And then pretty, I think like 6 months later was Noah.
Noah. Oh, yeah, because Noah was placed on
with
January 5th, because I remember because it was my birthday.
Yeah.
Yep.
Talk about that feeling, because you're on a team, you love this team, you guys love playing together, and then they all get on teams. Does the team stop performing right away? Do you...
We fizzled, yeah.
You fizzled. And do you feel like you kind of retreated a little bit from improv in general?
I remember taking breaks. I remember like giving myself like a month off. Did you do a similar thing? I remember a Twitter conversation.
We might have... No, I didn't take... I took a month off of UCB. I think I was doing other stuff outside of it.
Yeah, I took... That's what I mean. I took like an improv month off.
Mm-hmm.
You just had to re... It's so excruciating. It's just way too much. It's such a psychological, it's so destructive psychologically. Yeah. If you give your power to it, which at that point I was giving my everything
to
it.
Not,
this, it's really hard to not.
This is a garbage question. I'm a monster for asking this. But that Gethard coached the opera, which had Don and Kane on it. Was that at all part of it being painful to process?
There was I flat out said I should be on the opera. I think I said that because I don't even know who was on there.
It was Mujan, Laura Wilcox,
Elena, Johnny McNulty,
Opus, Kane, Finelli, Nate Russell.
Right. God, that was a great team.
I distinctly remember watching and being like, one of these people, several of these people are in the spot that should be mine.
I remember at that time watching and...
They weren't a good team. It wasn't like I was jealous of like the great work.
It was one of those things where, you know, teams aren't, you're never going to, it's not like a Sandino level team, but they're still getting to do shows. We'll bring up Sandino. They're still getting to do shows.
Yep.
There's like, I remember that feeling because I think around the same time, Mudan, when we were both like auditioning and not getting on, I think we had talked about it a bunch.
Yeah.
Because I might have felt in the same position as you. It's like, I was, you know, and I don't know how you feel about this, but there were teachers and like people being like, I think you're great. You're going to get like the first time I auditioned, I had two teachers say, you're going to get on.
Oh, yeah. This is your, it's your year.
It's your year. And I remember like not getting on and just being like, not sure how to process it.
By year four, you're like, oh, there's some label. There's some scarlet letter.
Yeah.
I just need to give in to that.
It's embarrassing. It's an embarrassing feeling to
it
me.
It is embarrassing.
When you don't get the acknowledgement that you think you deserve and other people think you deserve it too.
I remember during parentheses. Were you in parentheses?
No.
You were in parentheses.
Yes.
I remember we had some show or something and auditions had happened.
Yeah.
Mid-class.
I got cut during parentheses.
And Creature had been... Oh, you had gotten cut.
Yeah.
And Creature had been made?
No, it must have been Mr. Crime.
But a lot of people got on, yeah?
Yeah, a bunch of
people. Nobody from parentheses got on.
Wait.
No, that's not true. Everybody from parentheses got on. I don't think so.
I do.
I think people got on during. I think people got cut and got on during.
In April?
Yes. Yeah.
No, Creature was later because Mr. Crime came first, right?
I think Mr. Crime
I know what's right. Because out of parentheses, we put together an improv team that had Kolsky on it and George on it, and none of those people were on teams. So it was 6 months later. It was the auditions that made the team that Jackie Jennings was on with James Dwyer.
Do you know what I'm thinking of?
Deckard.
Do you know what I think I'm thinking of? I think I'm thinking of callbacks went out and a shitload of people
got
callbacks.
That's what happened.
Because I should also say, so my years of rejection, so it was five auditions over 4 years, and it's especially it was especially hurtful because I never got a callback, not one single callback.
I went through the same thing. And there would also be the thing where if you didn't get a callback, they'd send out a letter and
never got a letter.
Wow.
So I remember during parentheses going backstage and people were warming up and everybody morphed the warm up into a big hug around me because it was embarrassing of like, oh, another year where Mudon didn't get a callback. And it was this nice moment that built out of that. I think it's because callbacks had gone out.
Yeah. Yes, that makes sense.
I think that was the case, yeah.
Thinking back to those times of how much I cared, it's just like, I don't know if I'll ever care so much about anything until I have children.
Can I tell you a funny fight that we got into one time?
And your children are auditioning for Harold teams?
You didn't get a callback.
When I hold their hand, I drop them off.
Can I tell you about a little fight that we got into one time?
God, I'm so excited.
It wasn't a fight.
I love them.
But, so I was hosting the Kaleidoscope, and when I got on a team...
What team was it?
It was Standard Oil.
Okay.
I believe we handed it right over to Mudon.
Yeah.
Right?
I remember that.
So the Kaleidoscope is this indie show that is kind of a bringer show. You choose captains, but people have been hosting it for a while. Started by Alan Sarzynski.
Years now.
And there's been a bunch of hosts. I was the second host. Mudon was the third. And the way it's kind of worked is if you've gotten on a team or kind of were ready to be done, you could retire and pick a new host. So we picked Catherine. And loved it. It was really great. And I think at that point is when I started to I was just chatting with Catherine more at this point. This is even after Macro Scene.
After Macro Scene,
right?
Yes.
And so I get placed on a team after, a few years of not getting callbacks, actually never doing even a callback in an audition. I get placed. And then basically I remember the conversation being, I was not having a great time on the team. It was rough for me. It was a little bit rough. It was a team of veterans. It was like people who had been doing improv longer than I had even been in New York. Like,
that's
Ari
hard.
And Betsy
yeah.
have been doing improv for like 15 years. And I'm like this new person coming up. Yeah. I have all these problems. I'm kind of making the team a little bit of a shit show. I'm having a rough time of it.
Right.
I remember having a conversation with Catherine where Catherine was like talking about getting on teams. And I was like, Catherine, when you get on a team, it's not the best thing in the world. It's just whatever. I mean, it honestly is kind of depressing sometimes. And I remember Catherine's thought was like, you don't know what you have. It was kind of a me saying, this isn't as great as you think it is. And Catherine being like, screw you. Fuck you for having this opinion. You should not. You don't understand what you have. I would love to be on a team. Love to be on a team.
And I was right. I was right. And I try whenever I feel like, oh, I don't want to go into the city on Tuesday. I'm not feeling doing it. If you just take half a second and think about that audience and think of all the people who would give their left arm to be able to do that Tuesday night show.
You were 100% right. And at the time, I was like, oh, she'll learn when she gets on a team.
But I think, I mean, I do.
And he patted me on the head.
Yeah. I think you're both right, though. Because because I remember having a conversation with Catherine. Maybe it was around parentheses. It might have been when I got cut and you didn't get a callback. And I remember Tom Levin was somehow involved because I think he'd sent you a really, was this
oh my
fair
God.
To say?
Oh,
he
I'll
sent
talk
you a
about
really
that email.
Nice email that was kind of just a reminder of like,
oh, it was
teams
so funny. Can I talk about
yes,
that email?
Please do it.
So Tom Levin was also in parentheses, and he was wiser than all of us and never bought into the system, never gave it that much power over him, and just realized, like, oh, I have the ability to do my own creative content and didn't need the machine. And so he sent me an email that we still reference to this day called Deuteronomy Pussy. So Deuteronomy Pussy is the most brilliant. I have it in my inbox somewhere. And it's like, hey, guys, just wanted to touch base about, like, what the deal was with Deuteronomy's show on, Thursday night. We had a lot of group games that I felt like were really unfocused. And I'm really hoping that we can squeeze in another Saturday practice. Please fill out this doodle so we can find another time. I think we really need to focus on some more premise-based pattern games. And, you know, if one thing Deuteronomy Pussy is known for, it's really just, like, tackling, like, those really clear premises. And then the most fictional right. email that since...
A fictional house team. The idea was that this was...
Oh, a house team.
Yes, that, like this is from the fictional garbage house team that you got on. Right?
Yes, and it was just this moment of enlightenment of like, oh, this is what is on the other side.
Yeah.
And the email is 100% true.
Yeah.
We all have real emails like that.
Oh, 100%.
Flowing in our inbox. Yes. And to just like get that like dose of reality of like, oh, this is what we're... idolizing.
It's not just that you become like a king and then you walk down red carpets and go to galas. It's
right.
just
yeah.
another improv team. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Because
yes.
I do remember.
Deuteronomy Pussy.
I remember that conversation we had and I go back to it in my own head. And I'm like, I remember saying that. And especially when we got on a team together, I started to think about that. I was like, oh man, I remember when we were in this weird kind of conversation. And now we're just like on a team and kind of enjoying it.
Yeah.
And like doing it right, I
thought. So recently Ken made me watch all 6 Star Wars. I'd never seen Star Wars.
Interesting.
And he wanted
segue.
Me to be a participant. I'm going to, no, full circle, I promise.
Good.
So Ken made me sit through all 6.
Made
Did I
you,
say let?
Like, no, but you said made. And I think like, that's
made,
not really
like
fair.
Encouraged me to really right. do this thing that mattered to him. But I'm glad I did because now I'm a participant and can have this conversation, which is I really think that for that, when you're in that headspace, you have to be a Jedi about it.
Oh,
and by
totally.
That, I mean, if you have to like not want it, you have to detach from emotion. And through that, you will have your strongest powers.
100%.
If you are not a Jedi about it, you're going to destroy everything.
Yeah.
So your fists are so tight. Everything is so clenched.
And I think that's like what happens on your first team for a lot of
yes.
people. But I feel like in some ways you avoided that, Catherine,
because oh, totally.
I think you have seemed in the time that I've known you.
If I were
very
to,
zen-like it, about your house team experiences.
Thank you for that. I think that's true. I've never been a panic performer.
I think that's huge.
But because before Harold, though, I had Maude.
Right, and that taught you how to be on a team.
Yeah, and I already had stage presence from acting school, so I was never nervous about performing.
But also just getting neurotic about team garbage. I think some people who can
right.
be comfortable on stage freak out about nobody likes me and
yeah.
nobody wants
oh,
to do
no.
my opening and... We're fighting about coach. Terry sent another email that says we have to change coaches.
Right.
Exactly.
If
exactly.
I were to think about people on house teams that are Jedis,
yeah.
you'd definitely be one of them.
Oh my God. That is the
yes.
nicest compliment
because,
I've ever gotten.
Because I will say, your first team was
Guthrie.
And
that was your first Harold team. You were on Graceland on Lloyd Knight.
I was on Graceland
oh, yes,
for a hot
yes,
minute.
Yes.
You went through for a hot second.
Right.
You went through the Lloyd Knight system,
yeah,
which I think is rare for a lot of people who came up when you and I improv twins
right.
did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like as someone who I've watched you be on teams and even teams where it's like they're more on the aggressive side or more on, you know, I feel like you're pretty unflappable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As an improviser, do you think that that's one of your biggest attributes or is that something that maybe we're kind of projecting on you? Or?
No, I never really thought about it. But yeah, I never feel like a panic. The worst thing that's going to happen is you have a bad show or a bad scene.
Yeah.
And no one cares enough to remember. Like, yeah, I think because I had all those years of realizing it's not that big a deal or making myself realize that, and because I think of the Dreadnought background
right.
of, like, aggressively seeking out
those moments.
Horrible,
yeah.
like, really, really embarrassing. Like, nothing that can happen on the Harold Knight stage is going to be.
Yeah. I one thing about you as an improviser, and we can maybe get into more of a technical improv talk, but, like.
Ooh, I would love to.
And it goes along with being unflappable is I feel like you're able to bring, and this might lead us to our first Twitter question, you're able to bring a level of commitment to the reality that seems natural.
Yes.
And I think some people have to work to the level that sometimes I think you make moves that paint this kind of very like specific reality almost effortlessly. And I think it comes from the acting background. And let me ask you this question.
Okay.
From Tao Yang on Twitter, TYang209,
oh.
wants to know, say it again.
Tao.
Hey, Tao.
Hey, Tao.
He's great.
This is the question. You're a great actor. Do you have any recommendations for improving your acting skills to do better improv?
Mm.
And I guess that's related to what I'm saying. Do you think your acting skills is what kind of makes you seem unflappable and can be grounded in the face of craziness sometimes?
Yeah. What's his question exactly?
Like, how can you be, what do you think, let me rephrase it. So these are improvisers that aren't actors, right?
Okay.
What are things that they can maybe do that will help them with their acting in improv?
I think it was a Neil Casey 501 where he said this, at the end of the day, we are watching a piece of theater.
Right.
When you're performing on that stage, you are an actor. This is a theater and we are theater actors. And so, and obviously, like, Neil is obviously like the greatest Brilliant. Improviser in New York or mm-hmm. America. So if you are watching someone in that small of a space, and this was his quote, I still remember it. He says, that theater is 15 feet long and I can smell your bullshit from that far away.
Oh, interesting.
I didn't hear it. Anyway, so if you're not at least committed, I don't fancy myself a particularly gifted improviser, but so fall into your strengths. And if you can at least make it real and act like, you know, whatever the hell, act like a mechanic would as they're fixing the car. Like, if you can just, like, lean into the reality of that, like, you're mm-hmm. just doing yourself such a huge service and really, like, strengthening the piece overall.
Totally.
And if there's no, you can't, don't let them smell any bullshit, because then it's 100%.
You,
cheapens
Catherine,
everything.
You, Catherine, are 100% genuine in the moves
yes.
you make. You create genuine characters and, like, say things that sometimes get a laugh on Harold Knight, because I think people are so used to hearing the improv responses
yeah.
to things.
Yep.
And
yeah.
you'll give that genuine response that almost wakes up the audience in a way.
And you know what? That goes back. I'm gonna shout out Gethard again, but I mm-hmm. distinctly remember a class where he said, improv, all you have as an artist, as an improviser, is yourself on stage. I have to close my eyes or else I'll get distracted.
Please.
We don't have musical instruments. We don't have paintbrushes. All you have is yourself, your body, and like the experience that you bring to it. So all you are bringing to improv is yourself.
Right.
And it's just like such a, like, again, like such a, like, Jedi moment. But mm-hmm. like, that is all you have to bring to this art form. And some people are so afraid of being open or vulnerable or truthful on stage. And
yeah.
I mean, the truthful, it's so cliche, like truth in comedy. Like, if you have to be truthful, you have to be saying things in an honest, truthful way that makes the audience feel like they can give a shit
yeah.
about what the hell
totally,
you're saying.
Totally.
And you'll do that park bench of truth or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to see people struggle with that.
I
so
love
that
exercise.
It's terrifying
it's
for people.
Favorite exercise because
yeah.
it reminds people what normal people talk like.
Yes.
And then you can start to see them like, oh, you notice how you're not talking over each other? It's because you're listening. Notice the things you're saying are getting laughs. It's because they're genuine.
Yeah.
It's like one of those exercises that can teach so much.
I teach an ASH right now, and the focus of the ASH is like, talk how you talk. Be a person on stage, act real, be real. And the thing that I keep, and when I have classes that like feel like they're struggling to even achieve like what that should sound like, the short, I'm like, go watch Catherine on Harold Knight.
Totally.
Oh yeah. Like there, and there's part of that's like, I could just like, to make it make more sense, I've thought about being like, I might just call it like the Catherine Mudon class. Like, I don't know how else, as shorthand
the
to be
Mudon.
Like, this is what I mean. But also like, maybe you should be teaching it.
Well, I'm trying to think of other improvisers that kind of have that same ability.
Nothing, I mean, people have that ability. Nothing comes close.
Oh my God, you guys are, this is my favorite day.
I will say, Zach Woods kind of does this
Gethard
like...
Gethard too.
Gethard does too, but there's something about Zach's like... Even when he's playing a silly character, I feel like he's believing what he's saying.
Yes.
There's mm-hmm. literally, like you said, you can't smell bullshit on that guy at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that, you wanting to do that, came from watching The Stepfathers, because I feel like that is kind of a stepfather's trait.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, none of them are putting on like cartoony... Neil's yeah. rule of thumb for even character work was, if you couldn't walk into a deli and, you know, buy a pop as that character,
it's not a good character.
It's not.
Is that Neil or is that Gethard? Because I know Gethard said that to parentheses.
Oh, did he?
I remember
it
that.
As Neil.
I mean,
yeah.
that
I think
might
he probably
be,
took it from Neil.
That might
Maybe.
Be like a Kevin Mulaney note that everyone's
right.
just...
Yeah. I don't think either of those men are saying pop, though.
Oh.
I think that might be the Mudon twist then, on it.
Going back to the truthfulness, though, sometimes I'll see that exercise and people get very boring.
Yeah.
And very slow. When you tell people to play real, they hear boring.
Right.
And really
right.
slow. And I always yeah. think that that's very interesting.
Or like be grounded, too. Yeah. They'll get yeah. really boring.
Yeah. I wonder if part of why you're good at this, Catherine, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. But I think part of it is also you own your weirdness in real life.
Oh.
And I think people who are good at playing themselves but doing it in a fun way are people who also walk through life and they're like, I don't know, yeah, I do this weird thing. I just, you own it and you're comfortable with it. And it's not apologetic. And I think people who go through life kind of trying to keep their weirdness under wraps have trouble
Which
figuring out how to make that work in improv.
Oh, yeah. totally.
Right,
yeah.
right.
But I think
right.
you wear it on your sleeve. You're very bold about the ways that you are a strange person.
Unaware of them sometimes. My friend the other day was like, you're afraid to be like mainstream. Like, I think they were
like,
talking
what?
About my hair. I had to have my hair. They straightened my hair for a job. And so I came home and I had this very straight, very mainstream looking hair. And they're like, you never like to look mainstream. And I was like, well, I'm not going to make effort to look.
I'm not even thinking about
right,
that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's digress.
So you have been on Herald Night for how long? Since?
3 years?
Three
Could that
years.
Be?
I think so.
Because it was in June. You got on in June.
Mm-hmm.
June what?
No, I've
got
been
a Lloyd
house
Knight
performer.
Yes.
I've been a house performer for 3 years, so maybe 2.5 on
yeah.
Herald.
Do you have any 2-part question?
Okay.
Are there any things you've learned being on a house team that you could tell to newer people getting on teams? Mm. Something to think about.
Well, okay. So we're talking. What year is it? 2015.
Right.
The theater grows exponentially
totally,
every year.
Totally.
So if you are in classes now, it's not the same as being in classes in 2008.
Right.
And I remember Will Hines joking, like, in a what was it? Somebody was like, if you're here to get on Herald Night, like, this probably isn't the class for you. You're not going to get on Herald Night. And he said it in jest, but the statistics of it
it's
aren't
tough.
What they were when we were coming up.
Right.
And I remember Bobby saying, when he was, like, coming up, it was like 3/4 of them got on a house team.
Right.
They just were, like, making house teams left and right. And, I mean, yes, it was, like, filled with, like, Gemberling and Moynihan
right.
and all these guys. But the ratio of it right now is really, really, really make sure that you are pushing. Like, the Broad City, you know, paradigm. Is that the, Nicole, is that the right word?
The
Broad
paradigm?
City
paradigm.
No,
of Broad
yeah,
City.
It's
like,
called Broad City.
Pour yourself into whatever your
own
creative outlet is because you're going to get
will,
so much more mileage.
And UCB will come running to you when
yeah.
you finally figure your thing out.
Yes, yes.
So
it's
you're
a
saying,
false sense of accomplishment. At the end of the day, being on a house team is a false sense of accomplishment. At least with Maude, you have characters and sketches that are
right.
tangible and that you can take into an audition. But Herald is a very false sense of accomplishment.
So I guess a great way to think about it is like, don't look at this as a huge accomplishment in the now.
It's
think
a skill,
it as,
it's a muscle, it's a community, and you do not need Herald Night to have all three of those things.
Right.
You
right.
want the skill, so you go into a commercial audition and they say, can you pump up the,
right.
punch up the this script or whatever.
And on the other hand, just thinking about improv is like, enjoy it. It's not
yeah.
something that's like, this is the king of the, it's now a time for you to enjoy doing this thing you love.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Go watch Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. I think that's really important, and I think we try to say that a lot to younger students, like, hey man, it's... This isn't the end all be all.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I like to say is like, this setback is just like a tiny chapter in the book that is your career.
Yeah. Yeah. You really don't need it.
Yeah.
Don't give it your power.
And then my other question is, which is so funny to, you don't need it, but my other question
is. Watch, I get cut in 6 months and I'm like bawling in the lobby.
We
just sprawled out on that picnic
if
table.
If you get cut in 6 months, we'll do another episode where we get to talk about it. My
We're
going to
replay this one, though, right. and
yeah.
ask you if you still agree with everything you
like,
said.
I'm not a Jedi.
My other question is, and this is not the same as what we were just talking about, but everyone I think that gets on a team is looking for that, like, oh, I want to get on a team and have that magic moment or have that amazing Herald or like walk off stage feeling like you just changed the game, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like what's like a huge moment for you since being on Herald? Has there been moments like that? Is it a series of just smaller moments? Is there one moment that stands out as like, this was a defining time?
Do you know what? This is so, you're going to kill me, but this is so recent. This was like 3 months ago.
Really?
Okay, I'm going to retell this scene.
Please.
So Sean was on Higgins for a hot minute and he stepped out. I don't even remember what our regret. The suggestion was regret.
Uh-huh.
I don't think we did an opening. I think it was all organic.
We were doing an opening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sean steps out and he's just sitting at a computer. He's just typing. I pull up a chair next to him.
Oh,
so immediately.
This is such a funny scene.
We're in an office. We take a couple patient beats, which I love. Mm-hmm. Love sitting in those quiet beats up top. And I go, hey, Greg, you know you hit reply all on that email, right?
Oh,
it was,
God.
That move.
And it only made sense because the suggestion was regret.
Regret. Oh, my God. It was one of those moments where we all kind of knew what was going to happen.
And Sean had no second line. He didn't even second line it. He gets out of his office chair, goes, opens the window, and goes to kill himself by throwing himself out the office window. And just like, no, dude, it's not worth it. Life's too short. And so then we caught steam from there.
That
but killing
was
yourself because
such...
you accidentally hit reply all.
That was such an amazing moment. I remember
oh
that.
Oh my God. It felt so easy.
Yeah.
It felt so good.
That was when we were like hitting
that
a groove.
Scene.
Yeah. Wow. That's so, I mean, that's flattering to have been in the scene. I did not mean to bring up
you initiated
that question.
With nothing.
Yeah. I think we just both came out.
I checked
and
in with
sitting.
You. You had nothing. We took a couple beats. It just felt so easy.
And it was the first scene of the Herald too.
It was the most brilliant second move.
That was so much fun.
Oh, it's just silently killing yourself.
I will say, and to bring up Iggins again, your current Herald team, being on that team righted a lot of wrongs for me.
Really?
Because I just felt like I had had my career at UCB.
I mean, you
has
were
been,
overdue. You were so overdue at that point that it was.
Some
like...
people say that. You know, honestly, if I were to really judge myself seriously, I probably needed to be cut and off teams for as long as I was.
Mm.
Because I think it's what led me to be able to be on a team like Iggins and like. It was an interesting process, and you know I've had teams where I've loved and had troubles on. Like I've been on amazing teams with people that I fucking love, and looking back, I could be like, you know, I was a piece of shit. I was being terrible, or
right.
This team never worked. And getting back on Lloydnet was great. I love my Lloyd teams, but then getting on Iggins again was like, I remember feeling like this is the level of just relaxed you need to be.
Mm-hmm.
This is the level of support you need to have. I remember it feeling like it's something has locked in.
Oh, that's nice.
And that was, yeah, one of those scenes. I mean, that scene and a bunch of scenes with like Patrick and a bunch of like group games we did. I remember, I don't know, I love it. Do you feel like you're reaching the end of your Herald Knight career? Did you leave Mod Knight?
I did step after Bellevue resigned. I did leave Mod Knight.
Right.
And that was just mostly scheduling. This is another thing I'm trying to do, like in these years, is say no to more things.
Right.
Because you get so used to saying yes to everything. And then pretty soon your schedule is so full
mm-hmm.
that you can't even like breathe.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to say no to more things to open up my schedule for my own work and to.
Mm-hmm.
For my own work and my own. Lost my train of thought.
Like,
yeah.
Basically peace of mind.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
to open the universe up. Because if there's no room on your plate, then like the universe can't put more food. You know
right.
what I mean? I just want to, anyway.
Right.
So I'm trying to say no to more things.
Right.
So I did leave Mod and it did feel right. But Herald, I would never leave Herald.
Yeah.
We'll all get cut someday, but.
We all get cut. In the end, we all get cut. I don't know why I thought to ask that question, only because like looking back for me is like my final time on Herald Knight was this team that I think was so great. Like, what would you think if you were put on another team that wasn't as good as Iggins? Would that be something you could deal with? Because I feel like you probably, your personality definitely could. I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
You know
it's
I mean?
Hard because you feel every new team, it's like restarting. It's like, you know, it's like a breakup and then you're
right.
dating again and
right.
you have to get to know everybody's quirks and nuances
yeah.
and stuff. So there is that like chapter where it like feels like work or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And
I have a question.
Yeah.
Wait, what's your question?
No, I want to hear your question.
So my question is because when you got on, you had this reputation of being like such a like sought after coach.
Right.
Such a like great, solid teacher. You have this reputation growing in the community. Do you think that there's a difference between being a great performer and being a great teacher?
Absolutely.
Because over the years, I know that I would take classes with, you know, somebody who I thought was amazing. And then it's like, oh, they're not as good a
Absolutely.
Teacher
I,
as
I
they are.
I think being a good coach and being good at improv are related. And I think for both, to be good at both, you kind of have to, I mean, not really, because you can be good at improv and not be have full grasp of the rules. I think what ended up making me a good teacher and ultimately what makes people good teachers, I think, is if you had to figure it out.
Right.
If you're that person that's like just
yes.
naturally funny and never had any sort of adversity, it's hard for you to reflect and look at things in a very, like, let's figure it out type way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, getting cut was what pushed me into, like, all right, let's figure it out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you're starting to teach now, mm-hmm. right? How do you feel about your relationship with teaching and coaching as opposed to the improv that you do?
I mean, it is crazy how many 101 exercises. It's like, oh, we should be doing this at practice tonight. You know
totally,
what I mean?
Totally.
This should be at the Herald. We should do this exercise for Herald Night.
Yeah.
And it just starts on, like, day one, those good skills and, yeah. like, those good muscles.
I wonder what would happen if you made a Herald team go through the entire 101 curriculum over 8 weeks
so
together.
Good. It would be so healthy. Yeah.
It would be – the thing that's good about teaching, and you'll find, is that you're constantly dealing with the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
And you say them so often that what ends up happening is when you're doing scenes, some of those things can seep in. And that's at least for me. I don't know if that's true for everyone. But coaching a lot, you eventually start to hear yourself coaching. You're able to, like, observe yourself from a little bit outside of yourself. But I don't know. I think it's different for everybody. I feel like you would be a great teacher and coach for different reasons that I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, same thing for Nicole. But I don't know. I think they're related, but I don't think you have to be good at one or the other. I think you could be a great coach and not be that good at improv, honestly.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true.
But I don't know. It's an interesting debate because there are other times where it's like, well, if this person can't do improv, how am I supposed to trust this person? I mean, I think that's part of the big thing, too, is, like, being able to foster trust.
Yeah.
Like, if people don't trust you, it doesn't matter how good of a coach you are. They're not listening. Right?
It's very true.
But, yeah, enough about coaching. Do we have any final questions for me, Don? Did you want to talk about booking ASCAT? You did for a while, right?
Yeah, you did. And Dave, friend of the show, Dave Murray, specifically requested. It wasn't even a question. He just wrote, talk about booking ASCAT! !
Okay. I was given that volunteer position, before I was even on a team. So I wasn't on any teams. And then Nate asked me to take over because Purnell had gone to grad school or whatever. Mm-hmm. So Purnell had done it for like 7 years. And then Nate Dern asked if I would take over the role. And I was so glad, so grateful to have, like, oh my God, I have an official role at the theater.
It's just any bit of acceptance.
Oh,
you just drink
up. God. It's so true. So I did that for, I think, 2.5 years. And, that was really fun, and just, like, hanging out at ASCAT and, like, seeing everybody, and you, like, get to a point where Amy Poehler is like, hey, Catherine,
hey, Catherine.
And you're like, I could die tomorrow. Like, done. Like, oh, my God.
It's the best.
Yeah, I was such a, like, nerd in that way of, like, oh, my God.
At that point, were you, like, in and out of the community, or was that something that solidified you a little bit more?
Yeah, it made me feel, like, more involved. Because even before I was on a team, like, I did feel like I was at a point where people were, like, knew who I was.
And Kaleidoscope was a pretty big part of that.
Yeah, that was really fun. But, yeah, ASCAT is, it's neat. Like, you get to, like, reach out to all these people, and you get to, like, pitch this show. Mm-hmm. And, like, yeah, it was a cool job for a while. Again, with the saying no to stuff, like, it just got to a point where it was, like, I had to, like, clear my schedule.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a fun. It's funny. I did that, like, high school shadow the other day, and she tried to break the awkward silence. This high schooler, she's like, "Have you met any famous people?"
And you're like, "Yeah."
And I was like, "Oh, I guess this will be like a good parlor trick or a good conversation piece."
Let me whip out my phone and show you all these emails
here's
of
some
people that
famous
I have.
People. I have.
Who was your favorite? Not for being famous, but who was your favorite monologist that you booked?
Oh,
the one
God.
You were, like, the most excited about, and who also, like, delivered.
Ooh,
because did you go every week when you?
I would see her there a bunch of weeks.
I would try to go if I could, because Bellevue would rehearse on Sunday nights, so sometimes I couldn't make it out. But I would try to go.
Yeah, who's the one that
I could? Can I guess?
Okay, I don't have an answer, so please do guess.
Was it Ruby?
No.
I remember when I used to intern at ASCAT. I did a few years, so I saw every show.
Okay.
And the people that always delivered were Ruby, Adam Wade. Atamanik when he did it early on.
Okay.
And Birbiglia. They always did really well.
Okay, I'm going to go against that.
Ooh.
And I'm going to say, do you guys know Michelle Collins?
Yes.
Ooh,
she's great.
I'm not sure.
Okay, she's in LA. And so here's what I'm going to say about ASCAT monologists, and it's going to pull back to our Jedi being truthful conversation. Mm-hmm. So we tell monologists, if they don't know the culture of UCB, if they don't know improv, we say, just tell an honest story and have it be honest and detailed. Those are the two things, honest and detailed. And it's interesting to see famous people or like storytellers who can't go off script.
Totally.
Or celebrities who can't be vulnerable and won't tell you anything honest and are just going to be Jokey McGee. And it's like, oh, if you would just be honest and detailed, we could have an amazing story.
No one has to laugh.
But
it would just be,
yes,
yeah.
They do not have to laugh, but people are so enthralled if you will just tell them anything truthful.
Yeah.
Because they're already, you're famous. They're already so excited to be in the same room as you. Like all you have to do is tell them like something vulnerable.
They see you be jokey. They see you do this anywhere else. Yeah. Now this is something else.
And we would say the improviser's job is for the comedy. You don't have to be funny. You don't have to have this, you know, be a laugh riot for 5 minutes. We just need a truthful story. And people struggle with that. And it's very, very interesting. But Michelle, on the other side, is very comfortable, very gregarious, shameless, does not care. Like, she'll tell any sort of story. Mm-hmm. And the audience is just so ingratiated, and they are just, like, putty in her hands. And it's so interesting to watch. And Higgins was doing monologues for a while. Were you there for that?
The first show we did monologues, and I think we stopped after, and second show or third show.
We do monologues in 101. It's always hilarious.
Yeah.
Everyone loves hearing a monologue.
The thing that's great about monologues for improv to me is that the ideas you get are rooted in truth.
Yes.
So you don't find these like
corny
or like
jokey.
Kind of you find stuff that is funny because it's relatable.
Yes.
And there are times in like my 301 class where I'll be like, all right, let's just do a Harold Duff monologues because I can't watch them do Pattern Game anymore. And it helps them to have material to pull from that will help them. Like that's beneficial.
Because Pattern Game, you're like, oh, I have to think of a smart initiation.
Yeah,
I have to think of a clever initiation.
Yeah.
And a monologue, all you say to yourself is, oh, this moment made me laugh. Why is that funny to me?
Totally.
And then just reframe it and initiate.
That was something I learned at ASCAT was just, they're just watching and saying, what's funny? Let's go do it.
Yes. Let's put a unique spin on it. The thing that the audience already laughed at, let's blow it out. Mm. Oh, my God.
It.
I love it.
Catherine.
Thank you, Dave Murray.
Thank you, Dave Murray.
Thank you, Dom Manzalillo.
Thank you, Dom.
Yes,
Catherine, you are an absolute delight. You are the Jedi of the improv community.
God, I love this.
Absolutely wonderful talking to you. I feel like I could talk to you forever. Dressbull's nodding yes.
Yeah.
She can't. She just wants to keep hearing more.
I love it.
This
Catherine,
was a blast.
Thank you so much for being one of our very first guests on this new sort of adventure we're on. You can still see Catherine with her Herald team. Iggins, amazing team.
Wait, what? Can I ask?
Iggins is from the book My Fair Lady.
I know what Iggins
so
is
we
from,
pronounce
but you
it.
Have said Higgins almost the rest of this podcast.
Okay.
I said Higgins?
You have.
Uh-oh. I shouldn't have. I should have said Iggins.
It is Iggins.
I always say Iggins.
I don't want to keep saying Iggins and then be the only person doing
it. Okay, let's have this be the definitive moment. Do not call this team Higgins. It is Iggins.
Right. And your name is Catherine Mudon, like
not
music.
Not Catherine Mudon or Mudon.
Or Mudon.
Well, now that we've got all that stuff straight, thank you so much, Catherine. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Sean.
And we'll be coming back at you very shortly. And if you want to see Catherine, go see her on Herald Night with Iggins. Great team. And are you doing any other shows around the theater these days?
Yes, I'm the new witches. In Dorothy Goes to Hollywood.
Ooh, Dorothy Goes to Hollywood. Amazing show written by Glenn Buzan. Amazing writer. Amazing improviser. We didn't even get to talk about Seinfeld, but maybe we'll have to do that on another time.
It's a sketch show.
It is a sketch show, but
it's
I just want to...
YouTube.com.
YouTube.com.
Oh, is it on YouTube?
Oh.
Oh, good.
Then we don't have to talk about it.
Oh, good.
I got to post that.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, as soon as you shut this down, go straight to YouTube.com, type in Seinfeld, UCB Theater.
Keep scrolling.
Keep scrolling. There's going to be a bunch of
scroll
things.
Scroll for many,
There's
many pages.
There's going to be a web series by Dan Klein and Arthur that's a you
There's
going to
be clips from the real Seinfeld.
But yes, thank you for being here. And did we say blackout last time?
Oh, I don't know.
You know, forget it. Edit. Scene over.